First Samuel chapter 21. For now until the end of the book, it's basically the same story repeated. Saul and David. Saul's trying to kill David. David's on the run. David's a refugee. Remember, I mentioned last time we were together, there's more of David's life recorded in the Bible than any other person, even Jesus. And there's a reason for that. You know, the Holy Spirit who wrote the scriptures wanted us to see David's life. Now, David's not perfect, obviously, but he's a godly man. He goes through all these trials and tribulations, and we have the privilege of actually seeing him in the Psalms praying during some of these times. We'll see some more of that tonight, but there's a lot to learn from David's life, and he was a godly man in terrible situations. By way of review quickly, David has had to flee from King Saul, who is insanely intent on wanting to kill him. David's best friend is Jonathan, Saul's oldest son. And he told him, we saw last time, chapter 20, verse 22, he says, "Go, for the Lord has sent you away." So from that point on, David is a refugee. He never comes back to the palace until Saul is gone. And he said, and he's running for his life every place he goes. You recall, David made a covenant with Jonathan. Jonathan said to him, "God is going to give you all your enemies. God's going to lay all your enemies at your feet. When that happens, remember my kindness." And we saw parallels there ever. Remember the thief on the cross. Jonathan saying, "David, you come into your kingdom. Remember me. Look kindly to me." David does. David's good to keep that word to Jonathan's descendants. Now let's pick up where we left off. At 1 Samuel 21, verse 1. This is right after he leaves Jonathan. Now he'll see Jonathan again briefly, but basically he left for the last time. Verse 21, verse 1. "Then David came to Nob, to Elimelech, to the priest. And Ahimelech came trembling to meet David and said to him, 'Why are you alone and no one with you?' David said to Ahimelech the priest, 'The king has commissioned me with a matter and has said to me, let no one know anything about the matter which I am sending you and with which I have commissioned you, and I have directed the young men to a certain place. Now therefore, what do you have on hand? Give me 5 loaves of bread or whatever can be found.' The priest answered David and said, 'There is no ordinary bread on hand, but there is consecrated bread, if only the young men have kept themselves from women.' David answered, the priest said to him, 'Surely women have been kept from us previously when I set out, and the vessels of the young men were holy. Though it was an ordinary journey, how much more than today will their vessels be holy?' So the priest gave him consecrated bread, for there was no bread there but the bread of the presence, which was removed from before the Lord in order to put hot bread in its place when it was taken away." Now just stop there. Let's read on. 7. "Now one of the servants of Saul was there that day, detained before the Lord. His name was Doeg the Edomite, the chief of Saul's shepherds. David said to Ahimelech, 'Now is there not a spear or a sword on hand? For I brought neither my sword nor my weapons with me, because the king's matter was urgent.' And the priest said, 'The sword of Goliath the Philistine, whom you killed in the valley of Elah, behold, it is wrapped in a cloth behind the ephod. If you would take it for yourself, take it. There's no other except it here.' And David said, 'There's none like it. Give it to me.'" So David flees, and notice the first place he goes is to the tabernacle. Now we'll see here, he'll mention this. David's been there quite a few times. David goes here often. The priest says that later on to Saul. David comes to me often. He's a godly man. David flees to the tabernacle. Now the tabernacle is in Nob. It used to be in Shiloh, but remember that back earlier in Samuel, that great massacre where the Philistines happened there, and then the tabernacle was taken to Nob, which is about 2 miles north of Jerusalem. It's not far away. It's in Nob. It's where the tabernacle is. This is where the city of the priests is, it's called later, chapter 22:19. It's called the city of the priests. It says in verse 2, Ahimelech the priest. Now he's the great grandson of Eli the priest. He's a priest. He's a faithful priest. He's a good priest. He knows David. David knows him. It says that when David shows up with just a few of his men, he says he's trembling to meet David because he heard of the division. He knows what's going on. I'm sure it's all over Israel. Saul's trying to kill David. David's on the run. And no one knows quite what's going on, all these things. Now, David sounds like he's lying here to him. He may be. But notice, David never mentions Saul's name. He says, "The king has sent me." And some of the commentators say he may be actually referring to the fact that Jonathan said, "Go, because the Lord is get you out of here." David's not really telling Ahimelech why I'm here. He leads him to believe, sort of, that I'm on a mission from the king, but doesn't say which king. He may be referring to God, who knows. I'm not trying to cover for him. It just sounds like that's kind of what he's saying. And notice here, David comes, he fled. He has no food, he has no provisions. And earlier in Samuel, when the tabernacle was in Shiloh, where Eli was, remember the Philistines came, there was a great war, and they captured the Ark of the Covenant. And at that time, Shiloh was probably either destroyed or attacked. And then the tabernacle ends up being taken to Nob, where it's been for the last who knows how many years. The guys who figure this stuff out say, David, right at this point, is probably about 24 years old. I don't know how they figure all that, but that's probably pretty accurate. But now the tabernacle is in Nob. And David fled so fast from Jonathan, he has no food with him. His men have no food with him. They just took off. He's literally running from Saul. You see here several times, David's afraid. He runs. Several times he runs. Actually, he does something stupid after this in his running. But it says, he asks for bread from the priest. Now, he's not really asking for the showbread. He's just asking, do you have any food here? He knows this priest, and the priest knows him. Any food in hand, the priest says, no, the only bread we have here is the consecrated bread of the presence. Now, in the tabernacle, as you may recall, there were several articles of furniture. One of them is called the table of showbread. They would put 12 very large loaves of freshly baked bread every Sabbath day on this table of showbread right outside where the curtain was along the wall there for the Holy of Holies. And the idea of the showbread was just to honor the fact that it's God who gives us bread. God provides. God feeds. It's an honor. It's in worship of God who gives us everything we have. It's a reminder that all our food comes from God. It was an offering to Him. Now, every Sabbath day, that bread would be taken out of there and fresh bread brought in. Now, the priests alone, according to the law of Moses, were allowed to eat. It's consecrated. It's consecrated to the Lord. Only the priests could eat it. David's not a priest, nor are his men. Technically, he's not allowed to eat this. This was the showbread, which God commanded to be placed at the tables inside the tabernacle as a reminder of God's provision. It was replaced fresh every Sabbath. There were 12 loaves. And again, it's consecrated bread. Only priests could eat it. But think about it. Ahimelech says, I'll give you that bread. You and your men can have that bread. And David takes it, and he and his men eat it. Now that raises some questions. Why was neither the priest nor David condemned for this? Now think about it. Technically, they're breaking the law. David shouldn't eat this bread. It's holy. It's holy bread. He's not a priest. Only priests were allowed to eat it. But for this, we have actually the words of our Lord. It's on your sheet. Jesus spoke of this. Jesus actually quotes this. Here in Matthew 12, this is in Matthew, Mark, and Luke. It's on the Sabbath day, and Jesus and his disciples are traveling by a wheat field, and they're pulling heads of grain in their hands and eating it because they're hungry. It's a wheat field. Now, of course, the Pharisees, in their twisted view of the law, they see them doing that, and they say, you're harvesting. You can't do that. You're breaking the Sabbath. Well, we'll pick it up there on your sheet there in Matthew 12. This is Jesus talking. He said to them, he's talking to the Pharisees, have you not read what David did when he was hungry and those who were with him, how he entered the house of God and ate the bread of the presence, which was not lawful for him to eat, nor for those who were with him, but only for the priest? Jesus turns to them and says, haven't you heard what David did? What do you think David should have done? And he goes on there to say, have you not read in the law on the Sabbath, the priests in the temple profane the Sabbath and are guilty? He means that the priests have to work on the Sabbath. Are they guilty too? According to the Pharisees, twisted. Remember, the Pharisees took the laws of the Old Testament and expanded them to be a pain in the neck. I am sure when Jesus came around, many in Israel probably dreaded the Sabbath. Because the Pharisees had all these hundreds and hundreds of laws. You could pick up a 3-ounce stone, but not a 5-ounce stone. You could have a bowl of grain, but not a sack of grain. If someone got hurt in your yard, you could stop the bleeding, but you couldn't help them get up. Hundreds and hundreds of stupid laws like that. You could not pick up a child if he was like a year old or 2 years old, but a 1 year old. You had to know all these laws, almost like they were riding around on bikes beating people for not keeping the Sabbath. They had all these stupid laws. And Jesus several times got in trouble because of their interpretation of the law. Here they ride up on Jesus and they say, listen, you can't be doing that on the Sabbath day. He says, listen, guys, don't you remember what David did when he came to the tabernacle? He had no bread. He was running, and he had no bread. They were hungry, probably approaching starvation. Who knows? He says, they ate that bread. And then he said, don't you remember? Don't you recall? Every Sabbath day, the priests do all kinds of work. Are they guilty? Are they breaking the law? He's pointing out how absurd their interpretation is. Let's pick it up there again. He says, I tell you, something greater than the temple is here. That's an amazing statement. We'll come back to that in a minute. Something greater than the temple is here. And if you had known what this means, and here he quotes from Samuel. Remember what Samuel told Saul years before this? I desire mercy and not sacrifice. You would have not condemned the guiltless. For the Son of Man is Lord of the Sabbath. Jesus quotes Samuel. He said, if you really knew, he refers to that period in the book of Samuel. He said, if you knew what he meant, God desires mercy and not sacrifice. And then if Mark adds, Mark 2:27, he said to them, the Sabbath was made for man and not man for the Sabbath. Jesus is pointing out how hypocritical they are. What should Ahimelech have done? Let David starve? Think of it. He said, I have no other food here but the used showbread. You and your men are on your run. He just told them, I'm on an urgent mission. We have no time for food and we have no food. We're going to starve. What should Ahimelech have done? He said, well, I'm sorry, you're going to starve. You think he should have done that? Well, that's what Jesus is pointing out. Of course not. He should not have done that. The law doesn't work that way. I have in your sheet. The law was never intended to suppress kindness or to hurt people. The Pharisees were taking those laws and beating people over the head with it. I can well imagine they dreaded the Sabbath day. It was never meant to be something you dread. It was meant to be something you celebrate. But they took the law and they would beat people over the head with it. Had the Pharisees been in David's day, they probably would have condemned Ahimelech. You should have let him starve. You can't give him that bread. Remember what the bread symbolizes? God's provision. God's generosity in giving food to his people. Of course, David is God's anointed. Of course he should have fed him. Of course he should have. And if David's that, and Jesus is making the point, if David's that important, and he was, that he could technically break this law and be blessed for it, what do you think the Son of Man's going to do? If David could do that and get away with it, if it was right that priest should feed David, because David's the anointed one, then Jesus says, what do you think the Son of Man's going to do? And he says, someone greater than the temple is here. You've got to have all these laws. Jesus will say, the Son of Man is Lord of the Sabbath, not vice versa. I, the Son of Man, Jesus, I'm not bound by these Sabbath laws. I'm Lord of the Sabbath. And he says the Sabbath was made for man, not vice versa. While the strict letter of the law would forbid Ahimelech from giving this bread, compassion and a respect for God's anointed moved him to mercy. And that was the right thing to do. The Pharisees' strict legalistic interpretation would prefer David and his men starve. Jesus demonstrates that something greater than the tabernacle or temple is here. And that's me. And David at that time was God's anointed. And it was right to feed him, to help him. God never intended these laws to restrict and harm his people, but to be a blessing. Remember, this is God's provision this bread is for, showing how generous and how God so generously provides for his people. Leon Morris said, the need for human compassion must never be stifled by barren legalism. Yes, the law said only the priests, but David was starving. He had no food. And he was a very important person. It was right for Ahimelech to feed him. And he did. So in this section, on verses 4 and 5, eating consecrated bread, the priest asks, have your men been with women? Because it's holy bread. In other words, you guys have to be ceremonially clean. David says they are. They've been on the road with me for a while. They're very clean, ceremonially clean. But notice verse 7. We stop there. Notice verse 7 again. Wrong chapter, verse 7. Now one of the servants of Saul was there that day, detained before the Lord. His name was Doeg the Edomite, the chief of Saul's shepherds. We don't know much about this guy, but we're told enough. He's Doeg the Edomite. Now, the fact that he's called an Edomite isn't a good thing. In fact, the Edomites were not well loved by the Jews. Excuse me. The Edomites, you recall, when Israel was leaving Egypt and heading to the Promised Land, they tried to subvert them and subdue them, and they were evil to them. Later on, when Israel goes into captivity, according to Obadiah, the Edomites were cruel and vicious to them, didn't help them. Edomites are not friends of Israel, but this guy is apparently a convert to Judaism. But it says there he was detained at the tabernacle, meaning he went there to do something. He was very unclean or had to go through some ritual cleansing. So he's hanging around until he can actually do whatever he's there to do, offer some kind of sacrifice or something. But this guy is pretty highly placed in Saul's cabinet. He's the chief shepherd. Remember way back in Samuel, remember Samuel warned them that when you have a king, he's going to take all of your best of your sheep, the best of your oxen. The king would have thousands of sheep and all the best animals all around his palace. Well, this Doeg was head of all that. He was the head shepherd. He was responsible for keeping the king and his soldiers fed. So he's a pretty important guy. And David sees him there. They don't talk, but he sees them there. And so David probably starts to expect trouble. That's why in verse 8 and 9 he asks, are there any weapons here? Because David is unarmed. He has no provisions. He has no weapons. He ran that quickly. He ran away from Saul's palace. He's not ready for this trip. But he sees Doeg, and he knows there's going to be trouble. So he asks Ahimelech, are there any weapons here? And wouldn't you know it, Goliath's sword is there. Remember this massive sword, Goliath? Actually, the word is a scimitar, this big, long, curved sword, probably very decorated. David said, that'll do. That will do quite well. That's quite a sword he must have there. By this time, David's not a young boy. Now he's a man. He can handle a sword like that, though I'm sure it's still probably bigger than most other swords. Now, later, David will regret that he didn't stop Doeg right then and there. He knows what Doeg's going to do. He's going to go rat him out. He knows that. Now, David later, we'll see this tonight, will regret the fact that he should have stopped him right there. He could have avoided a lot of trouble. But he doesn't. David, in fact, notice how David flees. It says there, notice verse 10. Then David arose and fled that day from Saul. David's running for his life. He knows Saul is after him. He knows this Doeg is going to very quickly turn me in. I'm going to be in big trouble again. They're going to come out and try to kill me. But he sees Doeg. He knows that Saul's going to soon know I was here. Now let's read something really strange. David does something, it's hard not to think that this is pretty stupid. Just because he's running for his life. He's afraid. We'll see that when we read some of the Psalms about this time. He's afraid. A little bit. Look at verse 10. Then David arose and fled that day from Saul and went to Achish, king of Gath. But the servants of Achish said, is this not David, the king of the land? Did they not sing of this one as they did, as they danced, saying, Saul has slain his thousands and David his 10,000? Just stop and think a minute. David runs to the Philistine capital. David runs to the Philistine capital to the king. The capital city of the Philistines is Gath. He's carrying Goliath's sword. You've got to wonder what he's thinking. That shows you how scared he is or how much he feels the need to run. He's probably thinking, Saul will not follow me here. But David flees from Saul, runs to the Philistine capital of Gath, which is 15, 20 miles east of where Nob is. Right up to the king of the Philistines. Now, it says literally he's being taken hold of. They're holding him. They grab him. They know who he is. In fact, notice what it says there. It's pretty impressive. The servants of Achish said, this is not David, the king of the land. David's not king yet. They hear all these rumors coming out of Israel. David's going to be king. He's the one doing all the fighting. He's the one doing all of Saul's military victories. He's had great victories and great slaughters against the Philistines since he's been in Saul's cabinet, if you want to put it that way. And they even know about that song the ladies sang. Saul has slain his thousands, David his 10,000. These guys are probably all there when he took down Goliath. And now here he is. You can imagine what they're thinking. We've got him. We have David. And it says there, David took these words to heart and greatly feared Achish, king of Gath. I think David was kind of silly in going there. It was a bad decision. He probably figured Saul and his armies will not follow me here. And he's right there. Now, verse 13. So he disguised his sanity before them. And notice, he acted insanely in their hands. They've got a hold of him. He's in custody. They're bringing him to the king. And now he's scared. He realizes what's going to happen here. So it says David starts acting insane, like a crazy man. It says, so he disguised his sanity before them, acted insanely in their hands, and scribbled in the doors of the gate, let his saliva run down into his beard. He's acting like he's out of his mind, like he's a crazy, like he has serious mental problems. Then Achish said to his servants, behold, you see the man behaving as a madman. Why'd you bring him to me? They grabbed him. They're bringing him to the king. We have David. But David's dribbling on his beard and mumbling and acting crazy and writing on the walls and just acting like he's out of his mind. Do I lack madmen, verse 15, that you have brought this one to act a madman in my presence? Shall this one come into my house? It's an amazing story, really. David's quite clever. He has some pretty cool adventures. But if he flees to Gath with Goliath's sword in his hand, I don't know what he thought was going to happen. I don't know if he thought about this ahead of time. He just kind of ran, it sounds like.
Two evils, maybe, he figured.
Maybe, I don't know. David's a brave guy. He's very brave. He's not afraid of these Philistines. He's already slaughtered them many times. This seems kind of reckless.
Probably even a little bit foolish.
Hard to say. Hard to say. They bring him to the king. Now they know his destiny, and he acts insanely. And notice what it says there, verse 22. So David departed from there and escaped. Yes, so he's running from Saul. Now he escapes from the Philistines again by acting like he's crazy. But I'll stop here. Remember I said, we are privileged that all these things David's going through. David is a man of great passion and great faith, but also great highs and great lows. And we're privileged that many of the Psalms he wrote, he tells us why he wrote them. So you can see what he's thinking, what he's praying. And notice that I have on your sheet there. That's why your outline's so long. I put several of these on there. Psalm 56. It says, it's a psalm of David. It says, to the choir master, according to the dove, and far off terebinths, a mitzvah of David. Notice, when the Philistines seized him in Gath. He wrote this psalm probably right after he got out of there. He ran for his life away from the Philistines. And remember, he took rest. He wrote this psalm. He prayed this psalm, and someone wrote it down. Either him or someone else with him. Let's read this. You can see now what he's thinking. What's on his heart. He says, be gracious to me, O God, for man tramples on me. All day long an attacker oppresses me. My enemies trample me on all day long, for many attack me. Notice that. They trample me, they oppress me, they trample me, they attack me. He's running from Saul, he's running from the Philistines. He doesn't feel safe anywhere. He's well aware of the fact that every place I go, I'm in danger. Even that Doeg, the Edomite, is going to turn me in. He knows what's coming. But notice, how does David respond to all this danger? He's in big trouble. He has no rest. He has to look over his shoulder to hold. He only has a handful of men with him, maybe a small 3, 4, 5, 6 men with him, not many. What does he say? When I'm afraid, I put my trust in you. In God, whose word I praise. In God I trust. I shall not be afraid. He's reassuring himself. Lord, all this evil is happening to me. Enemies everywhere. I can't trust anyone. Enemies ahead of me, enemies behind me, but God, I'm reminding myself, I will put my trust in my God. You will protect me. You will bless me. Read on. In God, whose word I praise, in God I trust, I shall not be afraid. What can flesh do to me? Verse 5. All day long they injure my cause. All their thoughts are against me for evil. They stir up strife. They lurk. They watch my steps. They've waited for my life. For their crime, will they escape? In wrath, cast down the peoples, O God. You have kept count of my tossings. Put my tears in your bottle. Are they not in your book? He knows very well God sees him. He knows because God sees him, because God cares. David says, I know you're watching me. I know you know exactly what I'm going through. You know my tossing. David at night probably had trouble sleeping. Every little noise, what was that? Wake him up. He says, you put my tears in your bottle. David spent time in crying over this. Crying out to God with tears. Lord, but you love me so much. Like my tears are precious to you. You know what I'm feeling. You know what I'm going through. He knows in verse 9. Then my enemies will turn back in the day when I call. And notice this. In spite of all these bad circumstances. In spite of everything that's going wrong. You could say his life has really fallen apart. He confesses his faith. This I know, that God is for me. Get that? Or Paul would say, for we know that all things work together. He says, this I know, even though I look around me, and every place I see is enemies, and trouble, and death, I don't know who to trust, I'm running from everybody, but this I know, God is for me. That's faith. In God, whose word I praise, in the Lord, whose word I praise, in God I trust. I read, this is where our coins got the in God we trust from this psalm.
From David.
I shall not be afraid. What can man do to me? I must perform my vows to you, O God. I will render thank offerings to you, for you have delivered my soul from death, yes, my feet from falling, that I may walk before God in the light of life. He takes all of his troubles, his fears, and says, Lord, I know you're for me. I know you're with me. I know you care. I know you see my tears. You see my sleepless nights. But Lord, I'm choosing to trust in you. I'm choosing to be strong in you. I'm choosing to remind myself that you are my God.
But David here is so cool.
This is how a servant of God, man or woman, is to respond to these kind of horrible things. David's life is ruined right now. There seems to be no future for him. From a human point of view. But yet here's his prayer. Lord, I cry, I pray. They're all around me. They're all trying to get me. But Lord, I am trusting in you. Notice he keeps saying there, what can flesh do to me? I'm not fearing man, Lord. I fear you. You're God. And you're God Most High. David had a great faith. This is why, for example, God blessed him so. He had great faith. Exactly right. That's exactly right, Brad. That's what he's praying here. God is for me. Well, I'm not afraid of them, Lord. I'm reminding myself to calm down and be strong in you. That he prayed probably right after he ran away from the Philistines again. This is how we should pray. These are all instructing us. It's neat. You can not only see what he's done, what's happening, you can see what he's feeling, what he's thinking. When you see into a person's prayers, you're seeing into their soul, their spiritual walk. This is David's walk.
It's a neat thing.
Now, let's read on, chapter 22. Verse 1. So David departed from there and escaped to the cave of Adullam. And when his brothers and all his father's household heard of it, they went down there to him. Everyone who was in distress and everyone who was in debt and everyone who was discontented gathered to him. And he became captain over them. Now there were about 400 men with him. And David went from there to Mizpah of Moab. And he said to the king of Moab, please let my father and my mother come and stay with you until I know what God will do for me. Then he left them there with the king of Moab, and they stayed with him all that time. David was in the stronghold, or in the cave. David flees from Gath and runs to this place called Mizpah. Now today, in Israel, there's a 10,000-acre national park called, not Mizpah, Adullam. A 10,000-acre national park called the Caves of Adullam. It's full of caves all over this park. One of these caves, probably several of these caves, are where David was. Some of them are quite large. So, in fact, you notice David ends up having 400 men. Some of these caves are quite large. It's actually a national park today in southern Judah. David stayed there. And again, while he's in one of these caves, we have a psalm. David stayed there for a while. And we have a psalm. Let's look at it again. It's on your sheet there, Psalm 57. While he's hiding in these caves with all these men coming, even his family came to him.
He writes this in Psalm 57, it's on your sheet.
To the choir master, according to Do Not Destroy, that's the title of a song, a miktam of David, when he fled from Saul in the cave of Adullam. And here's what he wrote. Remember, what you're seeing here, again, David's hiding for his life. He doesn't know where to go. In just a moment here, a prophet's going to tell him where to go. But he's wondering, what do I do? Where do I go? I'm hiding for my life. I wonder how soon they're going to find me here. He's back in Israel again. So Saul has spies everywhere, and Saul has men looking for him. He's hiding in this cave, and here's how he prays. Be merciful to me. Oh God, be merciful to me. For in you my soul takes refuge. In the shadow of your wings I will take refuge till the storms of destruction pass by. That song, Hiding in Thee, I'm told is based on some of these words of David. Lord, all around me are destruction. All around me are these storms. But my soul is taking refuge. I'm hiding in you. Notice that beautiful picture of your wings. Like a chick has a hen has her chicks underneath her. I'm hiding under your wings. Lord, help me. He knew how to do this. He also knows with all this evil going on that it has a purpose. Notice verse 2. I cry out to God Most High. To God who fulfills his purpose for me. David believed in sovereignty. He knew the God of Israel, the true God, was sovereign. He knows all of this can't happen but by your hand. He knows that. These are your purposes. I'm in this cave because you put me here. This is all happening to me, God, because you're in charge of my life. He's taking comfort in God's amazing sovereignty. He will send from heaven and save me. He'll put to shame him who tramples on me. Selah. God will send out his steadfast love and his faithfulness. I'm trusting in God. I know he loves me. Even though now I'm in a very bad way, I know God's going to have compassion on me because he loves me. And now notice what he goes on to say. My soul, verse 4, is in the midst of lions. Imagine the picture of that. Imagine being surrounded by lions. How scared you'd be. That's very poetic language of what he's feeling right now. My soul's in the midst of lions. I lie down amid fiery beasts, the children of men whose teeth are spears and arrows, whose tongues are sharp swords. Again, he's just sensing, I have enemies, and they're powerful. Saul's the king. He has an army at his disposal, and he has many men out looking for me, and there are spies everywhere. I'm surrounded by lions who want to devour me. But notice what he says. In this great danger he's in, what does David really want? Well, notice the next verse.
Verse 5.
Be exalted, O God, above the heavens. Let your glory be over all the earth. In other words, not me, O Lord, you. And all of this, Lord, however this ends up, whatever you're about to do, glorify yourself. Show yourself for who you are. Glorify yourself. Verse 6, they set a net for my steps. My soul was bowed down. They dug a pit in my way. But they have fallen into themselves. Selah. My heart is steadfast, O God. My heart is steadfast. I will sing and make melody. Awake, my glory. Awake, O harp and lyre. I will awake the dawn. I will give thanks to you, O Lord, among the peoples. I will sing praises to you among the nations. For your steadfast love is great to the heavens, your faithfulness to the clouds. Be exalted, O God, above the heavens. Let your glory be over all the earth. That's not positive thinking. My life stinks, but God, you're so good. He means that. Be exalted, O God. Your steadfast love, your covenant love, your faithfulness. I'm trusting you. I don't know how this ends. I don't know where this goes. David is saying, no, he says, I'll awaken the dawn with psalms. Even in the midst of this cave, when everything is wrong, I'm going to worship you. I'm going to praise your name. This he knows. I trust in the Lord. His loving kindness to me never fails. I could hide under his wings. He's a strong tower. David knew how to take his troubles to the Lord and regain strength. And again, you picture him like Paul and Silas in a jail cell at midnight singing. David's in this cave rejoicing and writing these psalms and praising the Lord and setting a great example for the people who are with him as well. The reason why David's so written about in the scriptures, he's a neat guy. In this section, notice, David, it says there while he's in the cave, David's family came to him. His brothers, who a couple of years ago were making fun of him, now they hear that David's hiding in this cave, and his brothers and his mother and father come to him there. They actually are fleeing to him there. They join David. Now, there's a good reason for that. It's very likely that they fear Saul, and probably well they should. Saul wants David dead. He keeps calling him that son of Jesse. Well, Jesse's family is probably not feeling very safe right now. They're probably expecting soldiers to come knock on their door. Where's your son? Saul might even do something like taking them hostage. You come, you know, that kind of thing. We're going to see Saul do some horrible things here in this. So they probably don't feel safe. But they know David. They've seen what God has done to him. David's brothers bring his mother and father and the whole family to David in this cave for protection, to be with David. And also says there, verse 2, about 400 men. Now it says they're in distress. Doesn't exactly tell us why. It says they're in debt and discontent. Now, there's a lot of talk on this. Think about it. Think of a king like Saul. Think of the trouble he's bringing to the kingdom. He's a wicked man. He's making all kinds of trouble. I'm sure many people are afraid of him now. Many of David's old friends are afraid of him, especially those in distress. If you had trouble, you and your neighbor weren't getting along, you had some kind of problem, normally you'd go to the king to get your problem dealt with, to get your problem judged. Well, they're probably afraid to go to Saul. In fact, we'll see here in a minute, Saul's still sitting there with that spear in his hand, looking menacing and murderous. They're afraid to go to Saul, so they go to David. It says they're also in debt. Again, when you had a debt, you'd go to the king begging for mercy to be forgiven. Well, Saul's not one you want to beg mercy from these days. People are afraid of him, as well they should be. And discontented. They just don't like the way things are going. They don't like the way the government is. They don't trust Saul anymore. They see God's hand of judgment on Saul and God's hand of blessing on David. So about 400 men find David out in this cave. and join with them. He becomes his basically a small army around David. But notice what David does, verse 3 and 4 again. David went from there to Mizpah of Moab. That's a pretty long trip. And he said to the king of Moab, please let my father and my mother come and stay with you until I know what God will do for me. Then he left them with the king of Moab, and they stayed with him all that time, and David was in the stronghold. Why do you think David went to Moab for his parents? First of all, no, David is caring for his parents. Does that sound familiar? I'm in terrible times here. And if 400 men can find me in this cave, Saul's probably going to find me here. He takes a long trip with his mother and father to Moab, to the king of Moab, who apparently owes him some favors. And he knows who David is. And he asks the king of Moab, would you please look after my mother and father while this whole thing's going on? Remember, David is a Moabite. He's Moabite blood in his family. Remember that?
Yeah.
David is a descendant of Ruth.
David's great-grandmother was Ruth the Moabitess.
And so he goes to Moab and says, would you please care for my parents? He's very good. David's very good. He doesn't want his mother and father being involved in this. His brother's fine. They'll fight alongside of me. But mom and dad, you're not safe here. You're not safe around me. So David goes, makes this long trip, and protects his parents.
But I notice
God is directing David, verse 5. The prophet Gad said to David, do not stay in the stronghold or the cave. Depart and go into the land of Judah. So David departed and went into the forest of Herath. God sends the prophet Gad. It's neat here. God is directing David. David doesn't know what to do. He's going here, there. He's in this cave now with these 400 plus guys. It's probably not going to be long before someone knows you're there. It's hard to hide a crowd like that. So God sends the prophet Gad. Now Gad the prophet, he's one of three men who wrote 1 and 2 Samuel. Gad the prophet, Samuel, and Nathan are the three in 2 Chronicles, 1 Chronicles says, who wrote these books. They recorded the history of David. Later on, Gad's going to be called David's seer. He's the prophet God uses quite a bit in David's life to direct him. Gad the seer. He's a prophet. But God here is directing David now. David, I'm sure David loved to hear this. Because he's wondering, what do I do? Where do I go? And all of a sudden this prophet shows up and tells him exactly where to go. Go back into Judah, where you're from. Go back to Judah. So he goes to this forest in Judah, in northern Judah. But now, something terrible is about to happen. Let's start picking up at verse 6. You remember Doeg the Edomite, who saw David. Verse 6. Then Saul heard that David and the men who were with him had been discovered. Of course, Doeg told him that. Now Saul was sitting in Gibeah under the tamarisk tree on a height, notice, with his spear in his hand. Saul's still sitting there with that spear in his hand. Most kings didn't sit with weapons in their hands. Saul does. That means he's ready at a moment's notice to kill somebody. He's a very dangerous guy. Very unstable, and people are afraid of him. And the writer here wants us to know, Saul's still sitting there with that stupid spear in his hand. Though he's not very good with it, he's got that spear in his hand. Verse 7, Saul said to his servants who stood around him, hear now, O Benjamites, will the son of Jesse also give to all of you fields and vineyards? Will he make you all commanders of thousands and commanders of hundreds? For all of you have conspired against me, so that there's no one who discloses to me that when my son makes a covenant with the son of Jesse, there's none of you who is sorry for me or discloses to me that my son has stirred up my servants against me to lie in ambush as it is this day. Just stop there. Saul has surrounded himself with Benjamites. Because Saul's up from the tribe of Benjamin, figuring he can trust them. He's telling them to the Benjamites, you really think when David comes by and kills me and takes my throne, he's going to spare you guys? And he's sitting there ranting and raving. None of you guys told me that my son Jonathan is in covenant with this David and that you're all lying in wait to kill me. That's paranoid nonsense. But that's how he thinks. And I'm sure they're all standing there scared to death. They're afraid to blink. He's accusing them all of treason. You're all against me. Everybody's against me. You're all trying to kill me. You didn't even tell me when David, my enemy, was nearby. Verse 9. Then Doeg the Edomite, who was standing by the servants of Saul, said, I saw the son of Jesse coming to Nob, to Ahimelech, the son of Ahitub. He inquired of the Lord for him, gave him provisions, and gave him the sword of Goliath the Philistine. Doeg rats David out. I saw him. I know where David was. Then the king sent someone to summon Ahimelech, the priest. This is only about 2 miles away, 3 miles away. It didn't take long to do this. The son of Ahitub and all his father's household, the priests who were in Nob, and all of them came to the king. Remember, he calls for Ahimelech, all of his family, and all of the priests. Remember, Nob is a town of priests. They're taking care of the tabernacle. They're the ones who do this. He calls for them all. Go get them all and bring them all here. Let's read on. 12. Saul said, "Listen now, son of Ahitub." Just stop there. He's talking to the priest, the high priest. He doesn't call him the priest. He says, "Listen now, you son of..." Remember what he said about, he didn't want him to say David, he calls him son of Jesse. It's a way of insulting him. "Listen now, you son of Ahitub," he says, that's his father. And he answered, "Here I am, my lord." Saul then said to him, "Why have you and the son of Jesse conspired against me, in that you've given him bread and a sword, and have inquired of God for him, that he would rise up against me by lying in ambush as it is this day? You're a traitor. Why are you and David plotting against me to kill me?" Again, that's utter nonsense. But you see Saul here, this paranoia he has. Everybody's out to get him. He's scared to death. It's sad. You know, there's a lot to be said here about power and governmental power, Dean.
And evil spirits.
Yeah. When you've got that kind of power and you're not right with the Lord, Saul has very little walk with the Lord these days. All you want is to keep your power at any means, and you're paranoid. He hates his priest. Verse 14. Then Ahimelech answered the king and said, "And who among all your servants is as faithful as David, even the king's son-in-law, who is captain over your guard and is honored in your house? Did I just begin to inquire of God for him today? Far be it from me. Do not let the king impute anything to his servant or to any of the household of my father, for your servant knows nothing of this whole affair." Ahimelech stands up for David. He's a righteous, godly man. He's faithful to you. He's loyal to you. And notice he says, this isn't the first time I minister to David. He comes to me often, meaning David's a godly man. David comes to the tabernacle faithfully. David comes there and prays. David comes and talks to me often. And he's your son-in-law. He's the captain of your guard. He's fought battles for you. He honors you. He loves you. He's faithful. He's standing up for him, as well he should. And everything he says there is true. Everything he says there is true. It's not just like John. Remember, Jonathan, two chapters ago, tried to go to his father and say, "Why are you trying to kill him? David's your most faithful servant you have. He loves you." Of course, Saul can't hear this. Saul's full of rage and jealousy and self-centeredness. Now something awful is about to happen. Verse 16. But the king said, "You shall surely die, Ahimelech, you and all your father's household." And the king said to the guards who were attending him, "Turn around and put the priests of the Lord to death, because their hand also is with David, and because they knew that he was fleeing and did not reveal it to me." But notice, but the servants of the king were not willing to put their hands to attack the priests of the Lord. There's 80-some priests standing here. All the priests of the tabernacle are standing there. And Saul says to his soldiers who are standing around guarding his throne, "Kill them all. Kill them all." Think of that. Kill all these priests. These are the priests of the Lord. Kill them all. The soldiers here at least have some sense. They don't want to do it. They're hesitating. "We don't want to kill these guys. They know this is murder." Not only is it murder, they're murdering priests. That's an awful thing. And thank, you know, God, thank these guards. You know, God, they did a good thing there. He orders his men to murder the priests. They're not willing. They would not be, this would be a vicious crime against not only innocent men, but the totality of the priesthood. Kill them all. Psalm 105:15 says, "Touch not my anointed one. Do my prophets no harm." Remember, this happened before. Back in chapter 14, remember God told, through Samuel the prophet, he told Saul about the Amalekites. Remember he told him to do? Kill them all. Wipe them out. And Saul wouldn't do it. Saul wouldn't do it to his enemies because he wanted the plunder. He kept the plunder. Remember, that's one of his big sins. Saul wouldn't do this to God's enemies. But now Saul is saying about God's priests, wipe them out. It shows you where Saul is with the Lord. He is not a godly man. He's fallen badly here. Remember also earlier in chapter 14, Saul passed this foolish law. Remember they were fighting the Philistines? And Saul said, "If anyone eats food this day, he's to die." Remember that? And it was a long, drawn-out battle all day long. Remember, Jonathan didn't hear his dad say that? Jonathan eats some honey and is brought before Saul. Now he has to die. Remember what the soldiers say? No one dies today. Saul would make these stupid rules, these stupid, vicious, godless rules. Well, here he makes an even worse one. Very bad. But notice verse 18. Then the king said to Doeg, "You turn around and attack the priests." And Doeg the Edomite turned around and attacked the priests, and he killed that day 85 men who wore the linen ephod. 85 priests he slaughtered right there in the king's palace. And that's not all. 19. And he struck Nob, the city of the priests, with the edge of the sword, both men and women, children and infants, also oxen, donkeys, and sheep he struck with the edge of the sword. This Doeg's a nasty guy. He's trying to gain Saul's favor, obviously. He kills 85 priests of God, then goes to their town, probably with a few men, and slaughters everyone. This town is the priest's town. This is the town that was built where the tabernacle was so the priests and their families could live and attend in the tabernacle. It shows you the crime Saul is piling up here. You get a good attention to Saul's life. But this Doeg goes in there and wipes out not only these 85 priests, their wives, their children, and all the animals. This town basically is obliterated. The tabernacle is sitting empty. There's no one to take care of it. Think of it. Now, there are other priests in Israel. In fact, one priest here escapes. There are other priests in Israel who eventually rise up and take over the tabernacle again. But think of what a crime this is. Shows you where Saul is. Shows you what David's facing. Shows you what's happening in Israel. Israel's king is slaughtering priests. Priests are the highest in the land. They're above the king. And they're all slaughtered. Viciously slaughtered just out of envy. Just out of revenge. False revenge. That's awful. What an awful thing. It's a vicious crime against God and Israel. But notice verse 20. But the son of Ahimelech, the son of Ahitub, named Abiathar, escaped and fled after David. One of the priest's sons gets out of there somehow. He runs away, or they miss him, or whatever happens. And he runs and tells David what happened. Imagine David hearing this. David is in the caves, in Adullam. And his priest escapes with his life, runs to the caves, says, "David, he's killed all the priests. Abiathar and all the priests are dead. Slaughtered by Saul." Can you imagine David hearing that? Sad thing. Sad, sad thing. And also notice what's happening here. Keep your finger here and turn back to 1 Samuel chapter 2. This is also fulfilling prophecy. This is a first installment of the fulfillment of a prophecy. Remember how wicked Eli's two sons were. Remember that? And God warned Eli to stop your sons from being, remember, they were being immoral with the women. They were stealing the food of the tabernacle. They were just cruel and vicious, threatening people. And God warned Eli, "You talk to your sons, you make them stop." And they wouldn't listen to him. He didn't stop them until it got too late. In 1 Samuel 2, an unnamed prophet walks into the camp. This is in Shiloh. And tells Eli, start at verse 31, 1 Samuel 2, 31. This is 30 years before this, something like that. "Behold," God says, "the days are coming when I will break your strength and the strength of your father's house, that there will not be an old man in your house. You will see the stress of my dwelling in spite of all the good that I do for Israel, for an old man will not be in your house forever. Yet I will not cut off every man of yours from my altar, so that your eyes will fail from weeping and your soul grieve, and all the increase of your house will die in the prime of life. This will be the sign to you which will come concerning your two sons, Hophni and Phinehas. On the same day both will die. But I will raise up for myself a faithful priest." Remember, we saw that. "I'm going to wipe out your household, Eli. I'm going to wipe it out because of your wickedness. But I'm going to raise up a priest after my own heart." Of course, that's a great prophecy of Christ and of the other priesthood. Now, this is the prophecy that let me get back to where we were. Ahimelech is the great-grandson of Eli. And now this whole family's been wiped out except for one. This will happen even later in when David becomes king. The whole family of Eli, all descendants of Eli, will be moved from the priesthood. He'll get another order of priests in. after Zadok the priest. We'll get to that when we get there. But this is an early fulfillment of this prophecy made against Eli many, many, many years ago. And then David hears of this, and he starts feeling a little guilty, and he wonders what should he have done. Notice verse 22 of chapter. Well, 21. Abiathar told David that Saul had killed the priests of the Lord. Then David said to Abiathar, I knew on that day when Doeg the Edomite was there that he would surely tell Saul, I brought about the death of every person in your father's household. Stay with me. Do not be afraid, for he who seeks my life seeks your life. You are safe with me. David hears that and he realizes, I made a mistake letting Doeg go. I should have grabbed him. He knew what he would do. Again, David's running for his life. He's at the tabernacle. He sees his Doeg there. Who knows? Look, hindsight's always 20/20. But David feels guilty about this. Maybe he should. I don't know. Had he taken Doeg right then and there, this wouldn't have happened. Probably. Who knows? But it did. And David is. Notice David's a righteous man. He's feeling guilty for things he's probably even responsible for. Whereas Saul has no guilt at all. Saul has no repentance at all. And again, with this terrible incident, imagine, David's a righteous man. He loves the Lord. He loves these priests. Him and Ahimelech said, he came to me often. David and I were friends. David would come there and do his sacrifices and then get advice from the priests. And now they're all slaughtered by Saul. David writes a psalm concerning this. Again, it's on your sheet. This is neat. I love doing this. This is an awful thing. What would a man of God think? How would a man of God pray? Here we have the Holy Spirit telling us. Here's what David said. Psalm 52. It's on your sheet. To the choir master, a maskil of David, when Doeg the Edomite came and told Saul, David has come to the house of Ahimelech. He wrote this after this whole thing happened sometime. This is one of his prayer that was written down. Why do you boast of evil, O mighty man? The steadfast love of God endures all the day. Your tongue plots destruction like a sharp razor, you worker of deceit. You love evil more than good, and lying more than speaking what is right. Selah. You love all words that devour, O deceitful tongue, but notice, but God will break you down forever. We don't know whatever happened to Doeg. He's never mentioned again. But David here is praying against him. You wicked, lying tongue, you deceiver, God's going to take you down. I imagine he did. He will snatch and tear you from your tent. He will uproot you from the land of the living. Selah. The righteous shall see and fear and shall laugh at him, saying, see the man who would not make God his refuge, but trust in the abundance of his riches and sought refuge in his own destruction. In other words, what you did is going to bring about your own destruction before the Lord. David's mad. He should be. This is an atrocity. This is an awful, godless act. Verse 8. But I am like a green olive tree in the house of God. In other words, I'm a young plant growing up before the Lord. That's who I am. And I'm learning, and I'm not good at this. And note, in all of this sadness, where David's confidence comes from. He says, I trust in the steadfast love of God forever and ever. Again, in the midst of horrible news like this, David goes before the Lord and says, but Lord, I trust in you. I trust in your love. I trust in your everlasting steadfast love. Verse 9, I will thank you forever because you have done it. I will wait for your name for this good in the presence of the godly. That was David's prayer right after he heard this horrible news. And again, there's much you can learn here. There's much we can say. Godly men and women take everything to the Lord. And David did. It's sad. We wish all the Psalms of David had a subscript that told you what it was all about. But these we see. David takes his terrible times and his terrible news, and he's scared, and he runs to the Lord with it. So, Lord, this just happened. Lord, this awful thing. He lays it before the Lord. Lord, punish him. Lord, this is your job. You punish him. Lord, I know he won't get away with this. And then David reminds himself, but your steadfast love to me, it's all I need to know. And he reminds himself again about God's love. It's a neat thing. This is how servants of God are supposed to pray. We have much to learn here. Yeah, but this is neat, isn't it? This is more than just learning what happened. You're learning how this man of God, filled with the Spirit, felt about it. You see David's spiritual life. And he's not Superman. He's scared. He fled. He's scared. He's saying, Lord, there's lions around me. Their lips are like razors. They want to destroy me. I'm sure this bad news must have really upset him. But Lord, you keep my tears in your bottle. You know every tear I cry. You know everything I do. Lord, I'm going to stand by you. I'm going to praise you. I'm going to believe you. I'm going to hide in you. And God's going to do great things with David. It's a shame some of the sins he does later on. But David was a godly man. This is how Christians should pray. We should learn a lot from this. Anybody else? Are we close? Paul, would you close the prayer, please?
My dear Heavenly Father, we thank you that you are a God who avenges your enemies and is faithful to your servants.
Yes.
And we thank you for the example we have of David, of a man after God's own heart, of a man who, when he gets into trouble, he knows where to go for courage, for strength, for stamina in the time of trouble.
Yes.
He goes to the Lord. The Lord God Almighty, creator of heaven and earth, the one who rules all things and can overcome all things. Such a God like that is worthy to be praised, worthy to be to be brought into our lives when we are in the midst of trouble.
Yes.
Help us to follow the example of David and do so when troubles come our way.
Yes.
To recognize that he will be with us and that he will fight for us. Sometimes he will bless us, not necessarily in this life, but all for sure in the next. In Jesus. We thank you for all that you do for us. In Jesus' name. Amen.